So we didn't have the opportunity to do our Q&A last night, and I know there's a lot of questions, so we'll take advantage maybe for the next 20 minutes, and then if there's more, then we'll, inshallah, we'll continue after Fajr as well. So anything pertaining to anything we've discussed or related, there was one question that one of the brothers had asked. Well, I guess we'll just take it from everyone else before I start answering that one, inshallah. So are there any questions? As a general principle in deen, if you don't feel like you can achieve the inner dimension of a particular form of worship, that's never a reason to stop that worship. In fact, you just mimic what the people of piety would have done otherwise. So there's incredible value in that. That's number one. Number two is, the question is, how do you like work on engaging yourself in that way? Look, I think the power of dua really comes from recognizing our own deficiencies and recognizing our relative insignificance in comparison to Allah. So if a person can fully internalize that, then that conversation just becomes natural and inevitable anyway. I don't need to force that out of myself if I can really understand the reality of my insignificance in comparison to Allah's greatness. And if I can understand my general lack of servitude in comparison to what's most deserving of Allah, automatically the conversations come out. So it's the step would be to fully appreciate my circumstances, and if I'm able to do so, the dua becomes natural after that. Well, there's, you know, in deen, there's so many, besides just the worship that, you know, we consider ibadah, like for instance, salah and Quran and things like that, there's also inclinations toward things like, you know, muhasabah and tahannuth and things like this, which are basically periods of isolation where you just reflect in on yourself, your purpose of life, reflect on Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala's greatness. So those sorts of periods of, you can say, reflection are what are going to drive. Now, it requires a little bit of knowledge as well, right? Like if I don't know what sin is and disobedience is, no matter how long I sit for by myself, it's never going to hit home. So it requires a little bit of knowledge as well. But beyond that, it requires a lot of personal reflection as well. The other thing that I think is very helpful is when you sit in the company of people of taqwa and piety, and you spend time in their company and you just be with them, you'll notice their particularities with how they interact with Allah as well, how they speak about Allah, how they speak about themselves. And so that also has a profound effect on the heart. And then that sort of generates that understanding of, well, this is actually where I stand. So the question is, how do you strike a balance between, in the examples of Yusuf and the Prophet, we went over yesterday about how they would, well, I guess in your words, what they would sort of accept responsibility and blame for, I suppose, the faults of others or the aggression of others. How do we balance that with pursuing our own rights when it comes to anyone who does show aggression toward us or to someone else? Look, in the situation of both Yusuf and the Prophet, and at least in the descriptions that I had mentioned and the du'a that they had made, that was their discussion with Allah, not with anyone else. Right? That was a discussion with Allah, not with anyone else. رَبِّ قَدْ آتَيْتِنِي مِنَ الْمُلْكُ وَعَلَّمْتَنِي مِنْ تَأْوِيلِ الْحَدِيثِ. That was Yusuf. In our discussions with Allah, there's not really any value or benefit in blaming any outside source for anything. Whether it's some difficulty that's befallen us, we can accept that maybe perhaps this was a sin that I performed, or some challenge that faced us. Turning back to Allah and doing tawbah accordingly is only going to be of benefit to us. And that's what we're learning from the Prophet ﷺ as well. You know, did the Prophet ﷺ ever retaliate? For instance, when there was an aggressive force coming, was there ever a battle that took place? Of course. You know, if someone's rights were being usurped, for instance, a woman in the community or a man in the community, did the Prophet ﷺ, you know, intercede in a way that would, you can say, reciprocate that aggression? Of course, it was there. So the deen has established those principles of handling, you could say, the oppression of others toward a people or toward you by taking the necessary measures, whether it be that be reporting to the authorities, whether that be taking matters into your own hands, whatever it may be. That's never going to be negated from deen. But then, at night, when it's dark, and you're facing the Qibla, and you're talking to Allah, are you going to bring up all those things? No, you're just going to accept and say, oh Allah, if this was whatever, something wrong that I did, I ask that you forgive me. You know, it's interesting, it comes up, you know, when I said this yesterday, and I really mean it, the people of piety of the past, when some difficulty would befall the ummah, even if it was like a distance away, before, you know, trying to solve it in other, you can say, worldly ways, the first thing they would do would, they would look inside and ask, is there anything wrong that I'm doing or I have done that's contributing to the suffering or the difficulty of the ummah of the Prophet ﷺ? This was a regular reflection of theirs. Does that mean they didn't then participate or partake of the worldly means necessary to stop oppression? No, of course that was there, right? I mean, in this day and age, we've ignored that first aspect. And we've just jumped to the second. But they both are hand in hand. And that first part is essential. It's essential because, look, on the Day of Judgment, I'm going to be asked about this. I'm going to be asked about what contribution did I make to the tragedies of the ummah. And if I can't even say that I did tawbah for my own sins for the sake of difficulty being, you know, dissuaded from the ummah, the Prophet ﷺ, that's on me. So many other things are not in my control, but this is 100% in my control. And unfortunately, we've left it as a community. The first question is, do I need to ask forgiveness from other people? The question is yes. That means that everyone I've ever interacted with in my life, if I've usurped their rights in any way, it's expected of me that I'm going to settle that matter. And that's really important. It's important because if I haven't been doing it so far, that means I can go back and rectify it, right? If I have violated their rights. And it's a reminder for me moving forward that I have to do whatever was within my power to not harm another, not just Muslim, any human being whatsoever. So it's simple. I mean, it may seem awkward at times, but there has to come a time in your life, maybe when you're going for Umrah or Hajj, or maybe Ramadan's coming, and you just reach out to all of the people that you know and say, listen, you know, I'm sure at some point, you don't have to be specific. You can say, I'm sure at some point I've not fulfilled your rights. I hope you can forgive me. And as long as they respond in the affirmative, you're okay, inshallah. Somebody asked yesterday, well, what if they respond in the affirmative and a month later come back and say, oh, what about all that stuff you did to me? Well, they already forgave you. So, I mean, they can't go back and take that back from you at that point. At that point, you just have to leave it. That's a problem. Because they have a right to not forgive you. And again, that's what I'm saying. People ask this question all the time. It's a bigger reminder for us to be very sensitive to how we deal with people in moving forward. Because the reality is, for us to make amends with Allah because of something we've wronged Him for is very simple and very easy. It's a moment's worth of effort. For us to have to undo maybe the abuses or harms or whatever we've done to someone else, especially when they're resistant to it, that sometimes takes years and years and years of effort, far more than a tawbah for a major transgression against Allah. Think about that, right? So you have to be a little bit persistent sometimes. And sometimes you have to bring a third party in the picture. And ultimately, if they're insistent that they are not going to, then the ulama mentioned that, you know, a couple more things. You should be making dua for them. Not dua that, oh Allah, put it in their heart to forgive me. That's important. But also make dua for their success in this life and the hereafter. And hopefully that, combined with giving some sadaqah in their name, hopefully, inshallah, their heart will change over time. And if it doesn't, maybe on the Day of Judgment they'll change their mind, you know. But that's a tough situation to be in. Yeah. The question was, is there a difference between the general sort of asking Allah for forgiveness for the day-to-day mistakes that we may make in the form of minor sins or heedlessness versus major sins, etc.? There is a difference. One is, there are things that we're unaware of that we do against Allah. And the beauty is that the hadith mentioned so many different ways by which just partaking in certain acts of worship automatically wipe out the minor sins and those sorts of, you know, you can say subtle things that we otherwise miss. So for instance, a person who makes wudu, sins wash off their body. A person who prays Jum'ah and then follows it up with another Jum'ah the following week, their sins in between are sort of left. That doesn't account for the major sins and the major violations. For those, a tawbah is required, a sincere tawbah. But the sincere tawbah is no different than all the stuff we've talked about since yesterday, which is, it's not a 3-hour process. It could have been. It could have been, you know, for instance, that, well, you spent 18 hours in front of the screen looking at things that you shouldn't have looked at, so you should sit for 18 hours and do tawbah now. That would only be fair. But Allah is far more merciful than that, where, you know, 18 hours or 18 years of sin can be removed in a matter of 18 seconds or less. So tawbah should be done for some of the more sincere major, for the more severe major violations. Does that help answer? Okay. Now, that said, it depends on how particular you want to be. I mean, the people of piety in the past were very particular when they would do, you know, we talked about istighfar every morning and evening. That istighfar in morning and evening is really designed to help you and I recollect the mistakes of the day and ask for Allah's forgiveness for them. So yes, while wudu does so, and Salat al-Jum'ah does so, there is also a process of combing through my day and filtering out those things that I may have done wrong, or those times of the day where I was heedless, and I do istighfar for that. And it wipes it away. The other advantage of istighfar is that it alerts me to my deficiencies. If I don't sit down and reflect and do istighfar for instance, something I've said or done or time that I've wasted, the next day is going to be exactly the same as today. But if I sit down and I recollect it, and then I use a fine-tooth comb and I sort of remove it, then tomorrow I'll think twice before I do something that would violate, you know, what's expected of me. Does that make sense? Yeah. The question is, in general, how does one get rid of or, you know, address the diseases of the heart? And the second is, how does one control the nafs? I'll do the second question first. The nafs is easy because we're all doing it right now. The month of Ramadan is the perfect, you can say, design or setup for a person to be able to suppress their nafs and grow the heart. Suppress the nafs and grow the heart, and they go hand in hand. The more I grow the heart, the more the nafs is suppressed. The more I suppress the nafs, the more the heart grows. This is the sort of relationship. By design, Ramadan teaches us that fasting suppresses the nafs. Ramadan teaches us, expects us to pray much longer prayers in the evening. Prayer, when you pray in the evening, when you tie your hands together and you start praying, performing tarawih prayer, your nafs is suppressed. It can't speak to anyone. It can't eat food. It can't check, CNN.com. It can't do any of these things during that period of time. So you're actively suppressing the nafs. So active suppression of the nafs in and of itself is what controls it. The effect of that is the heart grows as well. And Ramadan's filled with activities that grow the heart. So those things that are heavenly, like sitting in gatherings, coming to the masjid, praying prayer, these things all grow the heart as well. That's the relationship. So what we learn from Ramadan, and hopefully all of us take back this lesson, because if we don't take back this lesson, then Ramadan is just a repeat once a year thing that comes and goes, and it's just, you know, something we enjoy and celebrate. The lesson that we should learn from Ramadan, especially at the end of Ramadan, is how do I feel right now? It's interesting. The fasting is much easier. We actually, for some reason, enjoy going to bed at 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock in the morning, being woken up 2 hours later, and we're all here right now at 6 o'clock in the morning on 2 hours of sleep, relatively excited to be here. I mean, we want to be here. Think about that. I mean, any other time of the year, if this was June, you'd be like, what's wrong with you guys? Go home. Or you tell your coworkers, go on Monday when you go to work, tell your coworkers, I had the best weekend ever. Oh, what'd you do? I slept for about 2 hours. I camped out in a mosque without my shower, my amenities, the food was, you know, not to my liking. Hopefully it was to your liking, but it was not to my liking. I was away from my family, my kids. I didn't get to watch TV. I wasn't able to hang out on my phone. We didn't go to the movies. It was amazing. They'd be like, that sounds like prison. You just described what you would do in prison. So why does prison feel so good for the believer at the end of Ramadan? It's because the nafs has been suppressed and the heart has grown. So we should take lesson from this when we leave the month of Ramadan as well, that if I just continue to do whatever I want to do, if my screen time is averaging 3 to 4 hours a day, it's a problem, and my nafs is going to grow, and I'm not going to be any happier. In fact, it's going to be the opposite. If I leave the month of Ramadan and I don't even look back at fasting again, that's a problem. My nafs is going to grow, and I'm going to be the miserable person that I've always been. Now, I mean, I don't mean to sound so negative, but that's the effect. If I go leave the month of Ramadan and I don't realize the value of performing extra prayer at night, like Qiyam or Tahajjud, my nafs is going to grow because it just nafs loves to sleep. It's going to sleep and sleep and sleep and sleep through Fajr and sleep through Tahajjud. So we're learning from Ramadan that to train the nafs and to grow the heart, there has to be a little bit of suppression through fasting, through prayer, etc., and growth of the soul. And that feels good. And that feels really good. The heart, when the soul is elevated, it brings this contentment to a person's life that you can't buy in any other way. I mean, if the recipe for contentment that believers have, especially at the end of Ramadan, was sold, you know, in the stock market, it'd be the highest stock on the market. That recipe, we're the only ones that get to taste it. It's just the mercy of Allah. But the world is looking for it. The world is looking for it. And, for those of you that are in work and school, you just talk with some of the people that in that situation, in your colleagues that don't have deen and don't have the ability to experience Ramadan. There's a lot of misery in the world. To answer your first question about the diseases of the heart, that's a very long discussion. But if I was to simplify it, we have an entire series on the website that covers all the diseases of the heart. So individually, if a person wants to review it, we covered the book of Imam Ghazali rahimahullah, and it goes through every single disease. But just to summarize it all, the core problem with diseases of the heart goes back to that whole differential I was talking about. Diseases of the heart largely exist because I'm constantly comparing myself to other people. I see what other people have, I want what they have. Okay, jealousy. I see, look at other people, I feel like I'm above them. Okay, arrogance or pride. So a lot of the diseases of the heart pertain to me just being caught up in this world. But if my attention is now focused in the vertical direction rather than horizontal, so I'm looking up to Allah, not literally, but figuratively, up toward Allah, and I'm constantly comparing who I am and who Allah is, and I understand that differential, it will eliminate 95% of the diseases of the heart. But we just don't have, we don't do that. We're caught up in people, we're caught up in relationships, and we rarely turn our attention toward Allah. If we get lost in Allah, then most of these issues become resolved. Not all, but most of them become resolved. That this issue of riya, which is a constant when people ask, how do I know I'm doing things for the sake of Allah, not for other people, when I have to give a speech, I have to give a khutbah, I have to lead prayer, that's because I'm so caught up in what other people might think. Hold on a moment. If I shifted my attention to what Allah really thinks of me and who He is and who comparison to I am, I could care less what other people think of me at that point because I'm so lost in just comparing myself to Allah at all times. If you constantly compare yourself to people, you're not going to go anywhere. If you compare yourself to Allah at all times, it resolves so much of these issues. You guys hear the question? You hear the question there? No? The question was, the month of Ramadan, as it sort of passes toward its end, we feel very sad about it. And there's almost a mourning that occurs when it does leave us. But then we're also concluding Ramadan immediately with the perhaps one of the most major celebrations of the year, which is Eid. And how do you reconcile those two emotions? It's a stark reminder for us that, yesterday we were talking about how the Prophet's du'as, they often start with Rabb or Rabbi. When a person truly understands that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is their Lord, then they're going to do whatever He asks them to do. And this is a perfect reminder that Allah Ta'ala tells us when Eid comes, you have to celebrate and enjoy and put a smile on your face. Even if deep down inside you're miserable because you just missed the month of Ramadan. We don't worship our emotions, we worship Allah. And if Allah Ta'ala wants us to do something, that's exactly what we do because we are marbub and He's Rabb. So this is the perfect example of it. You know, it's like, your emotions have to flip because this is what Allah expects of me at this time. So Ramadan, yes, sadness, you're asking for forgiveness, you're begging, your whole mindset's that way. And with the flip of a switch, Allah says, all right, time to celebrate. Okay, and we say, okay, let's do it. We're going to celebrate because we are marbub. We do what you tell us to do and you expect us to do, not what we think is appropriate in that moment. Does that make sense? Based off of the conversation, what are the best times for dua? The best, there's a few places in hadith that talk about the best times for dua. One is the time between the adhan and the iqamah in particular. The Prophet ﷺ said that that's a time where du'as are accepted. So that's important, we should value that time. A second time that's essential is, and this is the time that most of us miss out on, that's the time before the Fajr prayer in the last 1/6 or 1/3 of the night. The time where we would otherwise pray tahajjud. The reason it's a very special time is because the Prophet ﷺ says, it's a hadith, it's well authenticated hadith, that Allah Ta'ala descends to the lowest heavens, and at that time, He Himself descends to the lowest heavens, and He calls upon His servants, and He asks, who from amongst you is seeking my forgiveness? Who from amongst you is seeking, you can say attention, broadly speaking. So that's an incredible time to ask from Allah as well. We tend to do so only when we're in need. That's when we wake up at that time and make dua. But we're in need every single day for something. So that's the time to make dua. Even if you have you have difficulty getting out of bed, set your alarm for before the Fajr time comes in. while lying down in bed, wake up, make one or two du'as. If you can't think of what to make du'a for, you can remember me and make du'a for me, I won't mind. And then if you have to go back to sleep, you go back to sleep. But that's an incredible time to call on Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Does that help answer the question? And then of course the time of iftar is very important. So yesterday, if you noticed, before we broke the fast, we had everyone go to the front of the masjid and make du'a facing the qibla, because the time, the du'a at the time of fitr, at the time of iftar, is mustajab, is accepted as well. So that's a very, very special time to make du'a right before the fast as well.